Hello, everybody, and welcome back. I am Sharon Cunha, and today I'll be reading you HeraldReview.com, which is an online newspaper. I hope you guys enjoy this. Today is the 19th of June, and our first headline is "Man Accused of Conspiring in Terror Plot Due in Boston Court." Due in Boston. Two men charged with conspiring to help the Islamic State group are expected in court Friday for a detention hearing. A federal grand jury indicted David Wright of Everett, Massachusetts, and Nicholas Rovinsky of Warwick, Rhode Island, on Thursday. Prosecutors are expected to ask that they be held without bail while awaiting trial. Both men were charged last week with conspiring to provide material support to terrorists by plotting with Boston terror suspect Usama Rahim to behead blogger Pamela Geller. Rahim was killed by investigators who say he lunged at them with a military-style knife. Rahim's family has questioned that account. Authorities say The three men initially planned to kill Geller, but Rahim called Wright on June 2nd and told him he wanted to kill the police officers. Rahim was killed that day. Wright and Rovinsky were indicted on the material support charge Thursday. Wright was also indicted on charges of obstruction of justice and conspiracy. In a statement released Friday, Rahim's family said the indictment does not establish a connection between Rahim and providing material support to a terrorist organization. The family remained shocked by these allegations, the family said in a statement released by its attorney. Suffolk District Attorney Daniel Conley is investigating Rahim's death. The family also wants U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch to investigate. And our next story is Mabun found guilty of raping girl 13 in Decatur. Anthony L. Mabun was convicted of four felony counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse Thursday. As Circuit Judge Timothy Stedman read the verdict aloud after the jury returned from 3 hours of deliberation, the 46-year-old looked straight ahead, devoid of emotion. The jury of seven men and five women found Mabun guilty of raping a 13-year-old girl on several occasions during the summer of 2012, beginning July 4th in a hotel room and extending through August of that year. During the three-day trial, the victim gave a lengthy testimony of the sexual assaults, and Decatur Police Detective Todd Coaster presented two receipts obtained during the investigation when Mabun had rented hotel rooms. An additional victim from years prior also testified to establish Mabun's history of abuse. The decision marks Mabun's 10th felony conviction in 30 years, and because of his record, he will be subjected to Class X sentencing, which carries 6 to 30 years in prison and life registration as a sex offender. During her closing arguments, Assistant State's Attorney Diane Corey said the victim might have experienced pain, confusion, disgust, fear, embarrassment, violation, and overwhelming betrayal. This man, sitting at the defense table, violated her in the most personal way possible, she said. Assistant Public Defender Scott Reuter argued that the trial lacked any physical evidence, and the victim had reported new instances of rape months after her initial forensic interview with Macon County Child Advocacy Center. The tale is growing in the telling, he said. Colleen Burnell, an emergency rare physician at St. Mary Hospital, testified that too much time has passed to detect any physical trauma or collect semen from the victim when she administered a rape kit on the victim. Allison Elsia, a forensic interviewer with the Child Advocacy Center, testified that normally only one interview occurs to save the victim from reliving the event multiple times, but some studies have shown additional interviews to be beneficial because the victim might not disclose everything during the initial session. Assistant State's Attorney Kate Kurtz, head of the Office Sex Crimes Unit, said the victim gave credible accounts of what happened to the best of her ability during an extensive, uncomfortable questioning, and the evidence supported her claims. "Step back from the picture so you can see the whole picture," she said to the jury. Mabun's sentencing hearing is scheduled for 1:30 p.m. on August 3rd. And our next headline is Cutler witnesses speak of relationships. Indicator. On the last day of her life, Lisa Cutler was more cheerful than she had been in recent times, apparently as a result of her decision to finalize the divorce from her husband, Chet M. Cutler, and move with her children to California. Testimony from co-workers of Lisa Cutler showed that she had a new spring in her step as a result of her decision to part company with a man who had physically and verbally abused her for years, as well as developing friendship with another man. Evidence at the trial of Chet Cutler, charged with first-degree murder for allegedly forcibly drowning his 47-year-old wife in the bathtub of their master's bedroom the night of April 26, 2012, showed that he also found a measure of happiness earlier the same day. Chet Cutler enjoyed a brief visit at Fairview Park with a married woman, someone he had known back in junior high school, on the morning of the day Lisa Cutler drowned. In the hours following her death, he invited this woman, who he hardly knew, to move in with him along with her children. The man who brought a spark of happiness into Lisa Cutler's life and the woman with whom Chet Cutler was infatuated both testified on Thursday. They each testified that their relationships with Chet or Lisa Cutler were not intimate. On Thursday, the fourth day of the trial, the state also presented a forensic pathologist who asserted that the death was a homicide. Evidence as to what the Cutler children witnessed the night of the drowning, testimony from a woman who Cutler referred to as the hot mom at the funeral visitations, and a funeral home employee who Cutler called to tell her how beautiful she was. Cutler, who was heard much testimony about his unusual calm and emotional response to his wife's death, has been sitting at the defense table throughout the trial. Dressed in a black suit, white shirt and tie, wearing a slight smile, Macoun County State's Attorney Jay Scott said Thursday morning that he wanted to record to show the defendants will not listen to an offer of a plea deal. In a case in which the state has a great deal of evidence, defendants typically consider a plea deal instead of going to trial. Prosecutors wanted it to be clear that it was the defendant's decision not to entertain an offer. Associate Judge James Corley asked Cutler if it was correct that he declined to listen to an offer from the state. "Yes, sir," Cutler said. Dr. Craig Nielsen, a forensic pathologist who specialized in aquatic death, testifies that after reviewing the Lisa Cutler case, his finding was the manner of death was a homicide. "The basic is that neurologically intact, sober adults don't drown in bathtub," Nelson said. "People who are drunk, haven't had a stroke, or are not paralyzed, and do not have a seizure disorder do not turn up dead in bathtub," Nelson testified. "If they did, they wouldn't be a bathtub in a house in America because it wouldn't be safe," Nelson said. The autopsy and toxicology report shows that Lisa Cutler was a healthy, fairly young woman with no brain lesion indicating disease, no head injuries severe enough or drugs in her body strong enough to render her unconscious. No alcohol was found in her blood. There had to be some external factors, so the manner of that had to be homicide, Nelson said. The numerous injuries, mostly bruises found on her head, elbow, hips, and feet, were not severe enough to cause her drowning, but they did indicate that she had been engaged in a struggle. Moreover, all of the injuries were determined to have occurred at about the same time as her death. Bruises do not occur after death because they require blood to be pumped to the area where the blunt force has occurred, Nelson explained. The exception is the possibility of bruising at the point of compression during CPR, because CPR artificially creates a pulse. As autopsy photos of incision at the point of bruises were presented, Nelson explains that the dark coloring, which was evident in numerous bruises at both elbows, was indicative of extensive bleeding beneath the skin surface. That indicated the bruises were deep and that there had been a significant amount of force exerted to cause them. Under cross-examination by defense attorney Jeff Justice, Nelson said the bruise could have occurred a few minutes before Lisa Cutler's death, possibly as much as 30 minutes, but more likely closer to the time of death. Nelson said the forebodeness of the front and side regions of the victim's head could have been a result of pressure applied directly to her head. A photo of the right bicep of Chet Cutler was projected, which shows three diagonal scratches. There are consistent With fingernail scratches, said Nelson, adding they occurred at about the time of Lisa Cutler's death. The Cutler children did not testify at the trial of their father. Instead, the lawyer agreed on a stipulation in which the testimony was read to jurors by the judge. The Cutler boy, then 11 years old, said his mother did not have any visible injuries at 10:20 p.m. April 26. He had a look at his phone after she left his bedroom, after tucking him into bed and wishing him good night. The girl, then 8 years old, also watched Dan's mom on TV with her mother after dinner. After the show was over, the girl went to bed. Her mother followed her to the bedroom and read her a book. Her mother did not have any visible injuries at the time. She fell asleep while her mother read to her and did not wake up until it was time to go to school. Both children said they slept through the night and did not hear the sounds of the emergency personnel at their homes. A 38-year-old woman testified that she met Chad Cutler during junior high school and had not seen him since then. One night in February 2012, she was at Robbie's Grill along with her husband and friends when she and Cutler saw each other. They spoke with each other for a few hours, just catching up on each other's life. They exchanged email addresses. He contacted her by email the following month. Later, a meeting was arranged for April 26 at Fairview Park. He asked me to meet with him, so we got together just to talk, she testified. They met at 10 a.m. She brought one of her children along. The subject of their marriage just came up. He told me they weren't getting along, she said. He had left his wife after losing his job. Then he returned to her. He gave me a hug and I left and we said our goodbye, she said. Nothing romantic? Scott asked. Absolutely not, she testified. The following day, Cutler sent her an email message. He said his wife has passed away and he wanted to meet her with her because he wanted a hug, needed a friend. She went to the meeting place but could not find him. She did not meet with him after that. As she testified, she did not look at Cutler. When asked to identify him in court, she pointed at him and she stared forward, avoiding turning her head towards him. When her husband discovered emails from Cutler to his wife, including one calling her my alluring friend and one in which he invited her to move into his house with her children, he sent an email to Cutler telling him he was sending his emails to the Illinois State Police. A male physician testified that he first became aware of Lisa Cutler when they lived in the same neighborhood in Fort some year ago. When he saw her at the Hickory Point Mall in March 2012, they struck up a conversation. We became friends, the witness said, adding they texted back and forth, talked on the phone, and went out to lunch. Did it turn into a romantic relationship? Scott asked. There was no sexual relationship with her, the doctor responded. He said he last saw her the weekend before her death. Her demeanor was the same as usual. She seemed okay. Walked normally, talked normally. She said she wanted a divorce. On February 16, 2012, Lisa Cutler filed a petition for divorce in Circuit Court. The divorce was pending at the time of her death. The trial will resume at 9 a.m. today. And up next is Vigil Seeks Meaning from Massacre. And the picture caption here shows Christians raise their hands in prayer during a vigil at the St. Peter AME Church for those killed in the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, SC. Indicator. Grief over the death of 9 individuals echoed across the nation Thursday. A haven of worship at a historic black church in Charleston, SC, became a shooting ground Wednesday evening when a gunman opened fire upon a Bible study group. 9 died, including State Senator Clementa Pinckney, pastor of the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church. Police have arrested 21-year-old Dylan Stormroof in the slayings. To see good in a time of evil, about 70 churchgoers and community members gathered at St. Peter's African Methodist Episcopal Church on Thursday for a prayer vigil to be shared in grief and unite in faith. I think the hearts were heavy today, and across the nation, people were saddened and filled with disbelief and sorrow, St. Peter Pastor Vivian Clarington said. But when we came together, when we can come together, we strengthen one another. Congregation member Faye Price Lestrade, 67, whose ancestors' involvement in AME churches dates back to 1857, said the news of the murder struck her with a deep pain. Hurt. It's the only word I can think of to describe it. she said. "To think a young person 21 years old will have so much hate in his heart." In the midst of racial tension building through the U.S., Congregation member Artina Hartman, 63, said the issue will not dissolve in inaction. "We need to find solutions to the problem that we don't want to talk about, and that's racism," she said. "We can coexist and we can all get along, but we have to do it together. Silence is too often taken as acceptance in this country. People do not come from the womb filled with hatred. They're all taught to hate," Hartman said. Step Representative Sue Skircher said, "True forgiveness plays an important part in healing. There are times when it must be delayed. It's just too soon for God to ask that of us," she said. The vigil focused on uplifting sorrow with love and praying for the 9 families plagued by senseless tragedy. Samuel Hudson III, pastor of Trinity Christian Methodist Episcopal Church, told the audience that evil beckons for a response in hatred, but faith can empower others to grow beyond the extinguished dead malice. "The enemy will never have its way over God's people," he said. The room became an interconnected swarm of prayers as everyone joined hands and bowed their heads. Clarington said churches and different denominations from throughout the city contacted her to share their prayers. To keep the event from paralyzing churches across the land, she said, "Prayer will help to encourage others to move forward and care for one another. It's not about the color of your skin. It's about the content of your character," she said. And our next story is Bob Ford, the risk and reward of drafting Joel Embiid. Taking chances to fulfill great ambition, which has been the dominant philosophy of the Philadelphia 76er under general manager Sam Hinkie, invites two companions along for the ride, Grace Risk and the need for great luck. In Hinkie's world, the risks are carefully analyzed and calculated. Of course, there's no shock at this point. Hinkie wouldn't eat lunch without calculating the most optimal time to do so. A year ago, the analytic clearly showed the obtaining center Joel Embiid, a first-pick talent with a third pick in the NBA draft, was a cup in the comparison of value versus price. Players with his ability and potentials are both rare and unusually obtainable with anything but the top selection. Just as the year before when the Sixers were able to use the sixth pick to grab Nerlens Noel's, another who might have been the first pick, the Sixers made the risk or reward calculations on Embiid and said it was an easy call. Hinkie has been open about the uncertain nature of building rosters. "Not every chance worth taking pans out," the news last weekend that the fractured navicular bone in Embiid's right foot is still not healed a year after it was repaired with the surgical insertions of 2 screws was more than just a twig snapping in the forest. If Embiid is unable to get on a basketball court and stay there, it won't be because the analytics failed the Sixers. It will be physics, and specifically the pounding that a merely 300-pound man can exert on what might be an exceptionally fragile skeletal system. Before the foot fracture was discovered, prior to last year's draft, Embiid had missed the final week of his lone college season at the NCAA tournament because of a stress fracture in his back. All of this was known when Hinkie and his analysts performed a calculation that 2 bone injuries plus the burden of not having Embiid for at least 1 season was still an acceptable risk. What wasn't known and still isn't known was whether those 2 injuries were isolated bad luck for Embiid or an indication of chronic problems that will dog his basketball career. As we look at it today, the answer to that question could go either way. Embiid might recover fully and be the dominant player his skills indicate, then again he might not. "We're not going to bet 1,000 on every single draft pick. We have them by the bushful in part because of that. Because we don't have any hubris, we will get them all right," Hinkie said at the February trade deadline. "We're not certain we have an edge over anyone else. We're not certain we have an edge at all. That's okay. It's a hard league with 30 teams trying to clamber to the top of the same mountain and its condition, and there is no guarantee that the Sixers are being entirely forthcoming about its severity. Not that they should be. Plus, next week's 2050 draft, in which the team again holds the third pick, in an entirely new light. Previously, the assumption was the Sixer will take a lead guard, either D'Angelo Russell or Emmanuel Mudiay, a pair of 90-year-old 6'5" prospect with their own sets of risks and rewards, given the state of the team backcourt, that made a lot of sense. Predicting the draft and predicting Hinkie's is not light work. However, there is a growing suspicion the Lakers will take Russell's with a second pick, a suspicion based largely on Russell's cancellation of a private workout with the Sixers just day after a meeting with the Lakers. If so, that will leave the Sixers a choice among Mudiay, center Jahlil Okafor, Irv Duke, and a 7'1" Latvian powered forward named Kristaps Porzingis, also 19, whose stock rose appreciably after a recent workout for NBA executives that showed he can shoot, dribble, and dunk when unguarded. On Hinkie's scouting forays aboard last season, he made several stops in Spain to see Porzingis play. Will Embiid's setback lead to Sixers to claim another big man next week, or will they take one in one any case if he meet their strict best talent available credo? Had Porzingis played in the NCAA instead of Europeans last season, some scouts feel he might have emerged as the top pick. If Hinkie shares the opinions and can get him with the third pick instead, that will make three straight years in which the Sixers felt they got a bargain at the top of the draft. Shopping in the Dant and Ding Bing, it's dicey though, as is shopping in the European bin. Hinkie is awarded of that, but he does the calculations and decides what risks are acceptable. Unfortunately, there are no screws that can be inserted into the formula to ensure that the results will be as sturdy as the analysis. And up next is O'Fallon Scraps Art Festival after City feuds with founder in O'Fallon. An annual Southwestern Illinois Art Festival has been scrapped over a dispute between the event organizer and the city of O'Fallon. O'Fallon has canceled its late September Strange Folk Festival, a statement on the city's website cited misunderstanding, rancor, and conflict, and criticizes festival founder Autumn Wiggins. Wiggins had previously told the O'Fallon Art Commission that she planned to stop organizing the 10-year-old event in her hometown to spend more time at her St. Louis craft shops. Commission members countered that the city controlled the event. Wiggins sent a cease and desist letter after the O'Fallon Parks Department purchased a domain name for the festival's website. City Park Director Mary Jean Hutchkins told the newspaper O'Fallon wants to regroup and rebrand and move on from there. Our next headline is ADM Grants Spark Community Causes. Indicator: Craig Willis, president of the Ethanol for Archer Daniels Midland Company Co., stood in front of the children at the Boys and Girls Club of Decatur and said he'd like to see at least one of them grow up to do what he was about to do. And that was to announce Wednesday that the club is receiving a $117,000 ADM CARES grant to support its Triple Play Health and Power Hour homework assistance programs in the most recent rounds of grants that have been awarded annually by the company since 2008. Will said ADM has had a 25-year partnership with the Boys and Girls Club nationally. We want to help and make good, positive, healthy choices in life so we can strengthen the communities where we are, he said. Club Executive Director Bruce Jeffrey and Board President Marsha Livingston thanked ADM for the gift. Other ADM CARES grants of $100,000 or more are going to Big Brothers Big Sisters, Decatur Public Schools, and $25 per student for science, technology, engineering, and math education in 11 other districts and schools in Macoun County. Public school districts are Argenta, Oriana, Credo Gordo, Maroa, Fort Meridian, Mount Zion, Sagamon Valley, and Warrensburg, Latham. And parochial schools are Decatur Christians, Lutheran School Association, Holy Family, Our Ladies of Lourdes, St. Patrick, and St. Teresa. The Northeastern Community Funds and Good Samaritan Inn are in the process of merging, with $75,000 award to the fund's emergency assistance, microfinance loans, and nutritious food programs, and $32,500 for the soup kitchen hot meal program and horticulture job training, Decatur is Growing Gardeners, or DIGG, is a Good Samaritan's partner in that training called Mercy Gardens. Other grants include $50,000 to the Decatur Salvation Army for its Pathway of Hope program and Shelter for Homeless Men, Decatur Park District for Summer Parks and Playground Education, Perform Art Programs and more, Baby Talks for Family Literacy, Foundations and Early Head Start Program, Girl Scout of Central Illinois for Girl Scouting in a School Day, and SDM STEM Education. $30,000 to Central Illinois Food Bank in Springfield for its Food Diversion Solutions Project, $20,000 to Macoun County Court Appointed Special Advocates for volunteers, recruitments, and training, and the two Decatur Catholic Charities for its Med Assist and counseling programs. The Decatur Family YMCA is also in line to receive a grant of $20,000 to $75,000, but Executive Director Matt Whitehead said Thursday he had not yet been notified of the amount. I'm going to try to read a little bit slower. Okay, so for our next headline is Altoon Too Soon Unveil Miles Davis Statue in Alton. A bronze sculpture of jazz trumpeter and band leader Miles Davis. Okay, and for the last story before we end part one is Kane Coney being done no favors. Country music has taken its share of lumps recently. A month ago, we ran in these pages a story discussing the death of guitar solos in country music. Radio stations are insisting on the edits or making edits themselves in order to play more hits and have more time to shove in more commercials. That's nothing new. For years, rock music fans were conditioned to expect edits in what got played on the radio. The practice goes back as far as cutting the Doors' Light My Fire in half. Just from my senior years in high school, notable FM classics such as Bob Seger's Night Moves and Kansas' Carry On Wayward Son were butchered. Some people like me twitch nervously when the songs arrive via broadcast, even now, wondering if we'll get the shortened version or the higher quality original track. Then, just a couple of weeks later, it got misogynistic. A consultant to 300 country music stations prompted an explosion after his remark in Country's Art Checks magazine. Consultant Kate Kill said, "If you want to make ratings in country radio, take females out." Naturally, female country performers are really anyone who actually considers what Hill was saying, reacted with outrage, but he was firm in his position. Women like male artists. I'm basing that not on music tests from over the years, but more than 300 client radio stations. Randy Lewis pointed out in a Los Angeles Times blog that women not only have been the majority of the country radio audience, women also buy more men music than men. Of course, that doesn't mean women listeners do not want to hear women performers, and Hill certainly wouldn't discount the contributions of women like Shania Twain and Faith Hill, who topped not only the country charts but also the pop charts, and that was when the pop charts were still an indicator of high profile and widespread popularity and success. And that's not to mention Dixie Chicks and Taylor Swift, who have garnered CMA Performer of the Year's award since the turn of the century. When female artist complains about lack of respect or a double standard, that is exactly the thing they're talking about. We certainly could be in the middle of a stretch, not unlike when Twain and Hill ruled the country scene. Only now the names are Luke Bryan and Blake Shelton. A radio consultant has no reason to push stations in a direction that chases listeners away. But what is the point of saying fewer female songs on the radio will result a bigger audience? It seems designed more to put the name of the person making the declaration part of the discussion, instead of honest talks about what brings ears to stations and the quality of the work being produced. Will Till have suggested less airplay of men during the Twain reign? Will Tim McGraw and Travis Tritt and Toby Keith maybe have had something to say about that? Isn't Hill a suggestion, an insult to the country music audience as well? Almost as much as an insult as the idea of cutting down guitar solos, either for aesthetic reasons or to better suit the needs of advertisers. Of all popular music forms, country music is the one whose most popular song still sounds the most like they did 20 or 30 years ago. This can divide an audience as well. There are people who claim to be fans off the forum who still complain about how it sounds now as compared with two decades back. That seems to be more a function of performers and current manner of preferred message than anything else. Bro country may be the least and most despicable of disposable pop art of the moment, but there's nothing wrong with country music performed by whatever gender that can't be repaired with some quality lyrics. And now we'll have a short break before part two.